Susannah Halen was a healthy 24-year-old, with a loving boyfriend and a promising career as a journalist at the New York Post in 2009. Then, she started showing signs of mania, followed by seizures, memory loss, paranoia, psychosis, and near-death catatonia. Halen chronicles her experiences in the book Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness.
I can't hear their voices anymore. Her skin is so smooth. I stare at the doctor's cheekbones and pretty olive skin. I stare harder, harder, harder still. Her face swirls before me. Strand by strand, her hair turns gray. Wrinkles, first just around her eyes, and then around her mouth and across her cheeks, now line her entire face. Her cheeks sink in, and her teeth turn yellow. Her eyes begin to droop, and her lips lose their shape. The striking young doctor ages right before my eyes. I turn away and look at Stephen, who stares back at me. Stephen's stubble morphs from brown into a muted gray. His hair turns white like snow. He looks like his father. Out of the corner of my eye, I watch the doctor. Now she's growing more radiant with each passing second. All the wrinkles on her face smooth out. Her eyes grow pert and oblong. Her cheeks gain baby fat, and her hair turns a deep chestnut brown. She's 30, 20, 13. I have a gift. I can age people with my mind. This is who I am, and they cannot take this away from me. I am powerful. Stronger than I have ever been in my life.
Susannah Halen with an excerpt from Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness. At first, she said she thought her illness might have been caused by a bedbug bite. And then things spiraled out of control.
As the disease progressed, I became more and more psychotic and paranoid, and I started losing the ability to control my emotions. I diagnosed myself with bipolar disorder. I had a diagnosis, and I was very relieved to kind of feel I was part of a group, people with bipolar disorder.
Did you go to anyone to have that confirmed?
I did. I went to a psychiatrist who did confirm it, I mean, hesitantly. I went and saw her once, but she did give me antipsychotic medication following one meeting with her because I was that extreme of a presentation.
Wow. And then I gather there was one night with your boyfriend, with Stephen, when you had a really, truly terrifying experience.
Yes, that was the night I had a seizure. And I don't remember any of that time, but he does. So we were watching TV, and I hadn't been able to sleep. I hadn't slept for about 3 days prior to this. So I had really terrible insomnia. And he heard this kind of grunting coming from me. And he thought I was just really annoyed that I couldn't sleep. So he turned to me and said, you know, are you okay? And I didn't respond. And he saw that my eyes were wide open, but completely unseeing. So he kind of touched me and said, you know, are you okay? And all of a sudden, my arms shot out in front of me, and I began to seize, and blood and foam came out of my mouth. It was like kind of that moment, that first seizure, first of many to come, was kind of that moment that marked the line between sanity and insanity. And after that moment, creating memories became difficult for me. So I don't remember most of the time that happened after that first seizure.
One of the terrifying things about this, and one of the realities I guess you've had to face, is that that woman suddenly became someone else. You actually don't know her. You only know her by reports from others.
Yes. Initially, the second part of the book, which is my month stay in the hospital, I wrote in third person because that's how far removed I feel from that person, that other Susanna.
Now, that night, you were actually lucky to be with Stephen, weren't you? He figured out what was going on and, what, turned you on your side, assumed it was a seizure, got you to the hospital?
Exactly. Looking back now, I realize that this seizure saved my life. Because before, so much of this disease presentation had been psychiatric in nature or behavioral in nature. So you had all these kind of paranoid thoughts and these bizarre behaviors. But this was a very physical manifestation of the disease, and not everyone who has this disease has a seizure. So what happened was I ended up in an epilepsy ward as opposed to a psychiatric, you know, ward. So I think the seizure actually really did save my life.
So that's good and bad in a way. On the one hand, you were out of your mind, almost literally out of your mind.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
But you were on a medical ward where perhaps they might look for things other than a psychiatric explanation.
Exactly. That's exactly what the case was. Because I was at NYU Medical Center, and I was being seen by all these top neurologists and epileptologists and psychiatrists and neuropsychiatrists and psychopharmacologists, a combination of the two. I think because I was on this floor where so many doctors were coming through, that was key to getting an early and swift diagnosis.
When did things begin to turn around? Now, you had a lot of tests. Was this after you went in having had the seizure?
Yes. I had about two MRIs that came back completely normal, completely clean. And then when I was in the hospital, I got more MRIs, every single blood test you can possibly think of. Reams and reams of tests. Any test you can think of, I pretty much got at the hospital. And it was all coming back negative. On paper, I was normal, but I was sliding further and further away. So when I first got to the hospital, I was acutely psychotic and actively hallucinating. And as my stay progressed, I started to become catatonic, and I could no longer really communicate. And I would stare off and do these kind of strange mouth lip smacking movements and these abnormal body movements. I'd leave my arms out at 90 degree, kind of like almost like a T-Rex in a way, or a mummy in other ways. I would leave my hands out, these kind of abnormal movements. So that was kind of sliding further and further into a catatonic state that would probably progress into a comatose state.
Again, you describe this as behavior, but you actually don't remember it. You've seen it, though, haven't you? There was some video of you when you were in the hospital.
Yes, I was on the epilepsy floor, and they monitor their patients with video cameras.
For obvious reasons, yeah.
Exactly, because they want to be able to see the seizure. So I have actual videos in my possession. I don't watch them very often, of me in the hospital. And one of the videos that I have is me actively hallucinating. I'm shouting at the camera, I'm on the news, I'm on the news. And I actually remember being inside her. And I say her because, again, I feel so divorced from that person. And I remember seeing myself on the top of the hour news and believing that my father had killed my stepmother. That was what I believed. That was this kind of elaborate hallucination that I had, that my father had killed my stepmother. There are media trucks outside waiting to interview me.
Well, the good news is that you are here to talk to us about this,
yes,
which means you came through it. I guess we have to go back to that point and figure out what happened. The doctors were saying no hope, basically.
Right.
But something happened. Someone, I guess, happened.
My own version of Dr. House, my mom nicknamed him Dr. House. His name is Dr. Suhail Najjar, and he's a neurologist, epileptologist. You know, he's an amazing man at NYU. He did several things that were very unique, but one of the things he did was he took a very detailed history. So he took all of the presentations of the disease, the bed bugs he took into account, the numbness that I had, these early paranoid thoughts. Then I had kind of heart rate instability. He took all of these various components, and he was able to kind of put it together into a whole picture. And it was during that time that he kind of had the stroke of insight that he said, I'm going to ask her to draw a clock, which is typically a test given to Alzheimer's patients. Now, I was 24 at the time when this happens. So this is not a typical test you'd give to a 24-year-old. But he thought, I'm going to try. And so he asked me to draw a clock.
Just a circle with the numbers on it.
I actually drew the circle fairly well, which I learned later is an overlearned practice. So even people who have with severe brain trauma can still draw a circle. So I drew a circle, and I drew in all the numbers, 1 through 12, on the right-hand side, and completely left the left-hand side blank. And that proved to him that this was a neurological disease, not a psychiatric disease, because that was still something that was being explored.
This is where the title of your book comes from. He said, "Your
My brain is on fire," yes. He actually took my parents out of the room that we were in, and he didn't say it in front of me, but he said to them, "Her brain is on fire." He knew that this clock revealed that the right-hand side of my brain was likely inflamed. So when my parents heard, "Your daughter's brain is on fire," they were relieved. You wouldn't think that "your brain is on fire" would be a relief, but they were actually relieved by that.
Well, I suppose that's the beginning of the point at which you can begin to treat it medically rather than with a less certain psychiatric care. But how certain was it? What can you do at that point? Your brain is on fire?
Yeah. So at that point, they didn't know the answer yet. So he did a brain biopsy to check indeed if it was inflammation, because basically they wanted to start treating me with steroids to kind of reduce this inflammation that they believe was in my brain. But if you started the steroids and then tested for it, it might not show up. So he said, okay, we have to do a brain biopsy and we need to do it in the next 2 days. So they did a brain biopsy, confirmed the inflammation. There basically was still question, what is causing this inflammation? Because inflammation can be caused by a host of things. And he had read about a newly discovered disease that was discovered in 2007 called anti-NMDA receptor autoimmune encephalitis. And during that time, there was only one place in the world that tested for it, and that was at University of Pennsylvania. And he sent my spinal fluid to University of Pennsylvania, and that's how it was ultimately diagnosed.
And they confirmed it. And you were one of the very first people to be counted as having this, right?
I was a 217th person to be diagnosed with this.
In the world?
Yes, yes. And not the 217th person to have it. Distinction there. 217th right. person to be diagnosed with it.
So what did they do? The steroids took care of it?
Yes, well, it was a combination of steroids, which reduces inflammation, kind of quells the immune system as well, and immune therapies that take out these kind of harmful antibodies that are kind of the bad guys in the illness. Basically, your body creates antibodies that target these certain receptors in the brain, and that's kind of the key to the illness. So they kind of strip your body of these bad antibodies and replace them with new, so it's immune therapies. So fairly simple.
Tell me, how has this changed the way you think about mental illness?
Significantly. I can say with all certainty that during the height of this illness, when I could age people with my mind, there was really no difference between me and someone who is diagnosed with schizophrenia. The only difference was that I was cured. That's the only difference. So, of course, you have to look at that differently. You just have to. Though it's called a psychiatric illness, it's also neurological in nature. We just don't know the causes yet. And it makes you hope that one day, you know, this black box that is the brain, this kind of final frontier, that hopefully one day we will get closer to understanding what makes it work and what makes it malfunction, and get closer to understanding what the causes are of these psychiatric disorders.
Susannah Cahalan is the author of Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness.